local bishop to erect a shrine to Our Lady of Guadalupe. There are those who say Guadalupe is Tonantzin, an Aztec goddess who existed years before Juan Diego came along. The Spanish missionaries, knowing that she had quite a local following, baptized her into Christianity as Our Lady of Guadalupe. What they didn't realize was that Tonantzin was a goddess who could take away sins through secret rituals performed by her priestesses, the brujería. The missionaries, basically, made it perfectly fine for Catholic Indians to go to Mass, but also visit a witch. My mother was a bruja, and I grew up watching her clients come for all sorts of spells, to guarantee healthy babies, to bless a new house, to keep a son from joining the armed forces. When she lit a red candle to Guadalupe and recited an ave, Doña Tarano's liver tumor miraculously shrank. When she prayed to Saint Catalina de Alejandría, a family on the brink of debt came into a windfall. Of course, brujas are also specialists in justice when someone's wronged you. A curse from a bruja might punish a cheating husband, or unleash a rash on someone spreading gossip. People at the receiving end of a bruja's curse understand that they have done something to deserve it. A hex only works on the guilty. My mother taught me how to lay an altar and choose a cuchillo, how to learn what a reading of Los Naipes might say about my life. But when I was younger, I only cast spells for myself. I never expected to be a bruja here in Phoenix. But word travels fast among the Mexican community, and people have need of a good witch every now and then. I found, too, that when I was working magic, I had to focus so hard that for those few minutes, I stopped blaming myself for losing you. The day after you came to see me, one wonderful visit, then one awful one. I'm having trouble concentrating on the client who is with me in my santuario. Doña Vasquez, Josefina asks, did you hear what I just said? This is what I wish I'd told you yesterday. I'm not the person I was then, any more than you are. I have waited 28 years to see you. I can wait a little longer. Please come back. The spell isn't working, Josefina sighs. I have been trying to silence her roommate, a college girl from ASU who spread so many lies about Josefina sleeping around that her boyfriend broke up with her. I suggested a case of la lengua ardiente, the burning tongue, to teach the roommate a lesson. Did you use the candle? I had given Josefina one the last time she visited, black wax molded in the shape of a woman. Yeah, I scratched her initials on the face, just like you told me. And I got that ass-kicking hot sauce from Uncle Tio's Taco Palace, dipped the needle in it, and shoved it into the candle's mouth.
You lit it?
Josefina nods. And I pictured her stupid horse face, like you said, and then blew the candle out. But she didn't come by the next day to say that she was sorry. And if that's not bad enough, she lowers her voice. Then I found a cobweb in the corner of my apartment, right after I cleaned.
Well, that changes everything. Finding a spider web in an otherwise spotless space is a sure sign that someone is trying to hex you.
Josefina, I think your roommate may just be a diablera. Just as there are good witches, brujería, there are evil witches. Their hexes, unfortunately, can land squarely on the shoulders of those who've done nothing to deserve them.
Renee isn't even Mexican, Josefina says. She's from New Jersey.
If she's a diablera, she may just be telling you that to keep you off guard.
Josefina looks doubtful.
But she has big hair.
I start to get up. If you don't want my help...
No, I do. Really.
All right. Take a tablespoon of graveyard dirt and a tablespoon of olive oil and mix the ingredients with the index finger of your left hand. Sprinkle this with black pepper. Then spread it on the picture of Renee in your college freshman Facebook and bury it in a cemetery.
Josefina looks up at me, wide-eyed. What'll happen to her?
As the photo disintegrates, your roommate will feel more and more out of sorts. By the next full moon, she'll apologize for saying anything bad about you, and she'll transfer to a college in a different state.
A bright smile breaks over Josefina's face.
She digs my fee, $10, out of the front pocket of her jeans.
Thank you, Doña, she gushes,
just as Victor pokes his head in. He has never approved of my side career, no matter how many times I've tried to explain to him that this is not a job, but a calling. After a while, I began to keep the practice hidden. It was not that I was trying to lie to my husband. It was simply easier for both of us to pretend that I wasn't doing this anymore, even if we both knew better. This is Josefina, I say, introducing the girl to Victor. She volunteers with me at the Science Museum. Josefina thanks me again and says she's going to be late for a class if she doesn't leave now. When Victor and I are alone, he puts his hands on my shoulders and kneads a bit. How are you doing today? After your second visit yesterday, when I cried for hours, he was the one who sat across from me, rationing Kleenex. It was partly for moral support, partly because he loves me, and partly to remind me that no matter what, I shouldn't swallow my sorrow down with alcohol. I'm okay, I tell him. For now. She'll come around, Elise, Victor assures me. You haven't been in my life for 28 years. Why, then, after only an hour in your company, do I feel the absence so much more acutely? Victor strokes his hand over my hair. Sometimes I think that when I am hurt, he is the one who bears the pain. If you had grown up with me, this is one of the things I would have tried to teach you. Marry a man who loves you more than you love him. Because I have done both now, and when it is the other way around, there is no spell in the world that can even out the balance. The very first time I met your father, he tried to rescue me. I was working in the middle of nowhere, at a bar frequented by bikers. Not clean-cut college boys with axle grease on their hands who wandered in, dazed after their cars broke down. He saw me pinned against a wall by two Hell's Angels while a third threw darts at me. And he launched himself at the big man. As it turned out, I wasn't in trouble. The bikers were all regulars, and we did this little dog and pony show every now and then. But I fell in love with Charlie at that moment. It wasn't his golden good looks or his attempt at heroism that sent my head spinning. It was the fact that he believed I was worth saving. I was one of the ghosthood of Mexican Americans who lurked in the background of other people's lives, as chambermaids and busboys and gardeners. The only reason I was a bartender was because I could not sew a straight seam, so taking in piecework was not an option.
Besides, I liked bartending. The yeasty smell of beer rising from the catch below the tap made me think of places where wheat grew, places I'd never been. Every time one of my customers got up and walked out the door, I let a little piece of me go with him. I thought that at this rate, sooner or later, I could vanish completely. I gave your father a free drink to thank him for trying to save me. I don't think he noticed that my hands were shaking, spilling beer all over the bar. Charlie pointed to my jeans, which were covered with couplets from poetry that I'd read. I collected words the way some people collected shells or butterfly specimens. "I'd rather learn from one bird how to sing," he read aloud. But the rest of the E.E. Cummings phrase snaked under my thigh, hidden. "Then teach 10,000 stars how not to dance," I finished. "Why is that written on your leg?" "Because," I said, "I ran out of room on my jacket." "You must be an English major." "English majors smoke clove cigarettes and say things like deconstruction and onomatopoeia just to hear the sound of their voices." He started to laugh. "You're right. I used to date an English major. She was always looking at things like laundry in a dryer or toast and trying to relate them to the subtext of Paradise Lost." I knew men. My mother had taught me how to read the sentences they did not say out loud, how to wear a red cord tied around my left wrist to keep away the ones who only saw you as a single step rather than a destination. I could tell by the bitter almond smell that rose off a man's skin whether he had cheated on his partners in the past. But the men I had known were like me, boys who had grown up dreaming in Spanish, boys who believed you could light a red candle for a dose of luck, boys who knew that a man who spoke ill of his girlfriend might find his tongue stuck to the roof of his mouth when he awakened. Men like Charlie, on the other hand, went to universities and wrestled with mathematical theorems and combined chemicals to watch them rise in lovely clouds of invisible gas. Men like Charlie were not meant for girls like me. "If you're not an English major," he asked, "then what do you do?" I looked at him as if he were crazy. Did he not see the four walls of this squat building around me? Did he think I was here because I liked the view? But I wanted him to know that there was more to me than just this job. I wanted him to think I was mysterious and different, and anyone except the person I really was, a Mexican girl who did not live in the same world as people like him. So I took my deck of cards out from beneath the counter. "I read Los Naipes." "Tarot?" he said. "I don't buy that stuff." "Then you have nothing to lose." I opened the wooden box that held my deck and removed them, as usual, with my left hand. Then I said an Ave and looked up at him. "Don't you want to know if you'll get your wish?" "What wish?" "That," I told him, "is up to you." He smiled so slowly that I had to look down. "All right, then. Tell me my future." I had him cut the deck three times for the Holy Trinity and hand them back to me. Then I laid out 9 cards, 4 in the shape of the cross, 5 and 6 balanced below the arms of it, 7 at the base, 8 tipped on its side at the very bottom, and the last card smack in the center of them all. "The first card," I said, turning it over, "shows your state of mind." It was the Seven of Wands. "God, I hope it means money, especially if it's my engine that's dead." "It's a message," I told him. "It says that the truth can't stay hidden forever. These next three cards will tell you who's going to help you figure it out." I flipped them over. "This is interesting. The Lovers. Well, that's just what you'd think. A happy couple. Some sort of romantic relationship is going to be instrumental in helping you get what you want. The Strength card isn't as good as it sounds. It tells you not to take on more than you can handle. But I think that the Chariot cancels that out because it's powerful and means you're going to ultimately have good luck." I turned over cards 5 and 6. "The 8 of Wands is a warning against ugly actions that might destroy you. And this card, the Hanged Man. Have you been committing any crimes lately? Because that's usually what this represents. Someone who better mend his ways, or God will get him, even if the law doesn't." "I jaywalked yesterday," Charlie said. Cards 7 and 8 were the enemies plotting against him. "These are both great cards," I said. "This is a child who's important to you and who brings balance to your life." "I don't really know any kids." "A brother or sister?" I asked. "No nieces, nephews?" "Not even a cousin." I started scrubbing down the bar, although it was perfectly clean. "Then maybe it's yours," I said. "Sometime." His hand crossed the wood, fingered the card. "What's she going to look like?" The suit was Cups. "Light-skinned and dark-haired." "Like you," he said. I blushed and busied myself by turning over the last card. "This lets you know if your wish will come true, or if all those other things will get in the way." The card was the 7 of Cups, a wedding or alliance he would regret for the rest of his life. "So?" Charlie asked, and his voice rang with the future. "Do I get what I want?" "Absolutely," I lied. And then I leaned across the bar and kissed him over the map of our lives. "I never forgot you. I have boxes somewhere in the crawl space of the garage, full of the Christmas gifts and birthday presents you weren't here to open. Stuffed animals and charm bracelets, sequined slippers and dress-up clothes that would have fit you way back when. Once Victor realized that I was still buying for you, he got upset. It wasn't healthy, he told me. And he made me promise I would stop. Not everyone understands how you can spin 2 lassos at the same time, one of hope and one of grief. When the elementary school you might have attended held its 5th grade send-off, I went to the auditorium and listened to everyone else's children dream of what they might grow up to be. A paleontologist, a recording star, the first astronaut to walk on Mars. I imagined you wearing braids, although that would have been too babyish a style for you by then. I celebrated your sweet 16 at the Biltmore, where I made the penguin-breasted waiter serve tea for 2, although you were not sitting across from me. I never stopped hoping that you'd come home, but I did stop expecting it. Having your breath freeze up every time the doorbell chimes or the phone rings takes its toll on a person. And whether it is conscious or not, you eventually make the decision to divide your life in half, before and after, with loss being that tight bubble in the middle. You can move around in spite of it. You can laugh and smile and carry on with your life. But all it takes is one slow range of motion, a doubling over, to be fully aware of the empty space at your center. When you love someone more than he loves you, you'll do anything to switch the scales. You dress the way you think he'd like you to dress. You pick up his favorite figures of expression. You tell yourself that if you recreate yourself in his image, then he will crave you the same way you crave him. Maybe you understand what happened between me and Charlie better than anyone else would. When you are told you're someone you aren't, over and over, you begin to believe it. You live that life. But you are wearing a mask, one that might slip if you aren't careful. You wonder what he will do when he finds out. You know you are bound to disappoint him. There was a moment, I admit, where I thought I had made him love me as much as I needed him to. When you were about 18 months old, I got pregnant again. Charlie would sneak out of work during his lunch break and come home to me. He'd rest his head on my belly. "Matthew Matthews," he'd say, trying names on for size to make me laugh. "Banjo." "Sprocket." "No, cortisone. Court for short." He'd bring me little gifts from the pharmacy. Chocolate candy bars, cocoa butter, butterfly hair clips. I was 21 weeks along when my membranes ruptured. The baby was perfect. A little boy, the size of a human heart. I developed an infection, started bleeding. I was taken back to the OR and given a hysterectomy. The doctors used words like uterine atony and artery ligation, disseminated intravascular coagulation. But all I heard was that I couldn't have any more children. I knew, even if no one was willing to say it to me, that this had been my fault, some fatal flaw in me. And when I came home from the hospital, I realized that Charlie knew this too. He couldn't stand to look at me when I came home from the hospital. He spent more and more time in the office. He took you with him. I drank a lot before I met your father, but I honestly think it took that miscarriage to make me an alcoholic. I drank until I didn't see the regret in Charlie's eyes. I drank until even he could plainly see that I was a failure. I drank until I couldn't feel anything, most of all his touch. I think there was a part of me that knew if I drove him away, I would never have to say I'd been left behind. But mostly I drank because that was when I could feel your baby brother swimming through me like a silver fish. I didn't know until it was too late that trying to hold on to the baby I'd lost was going to cost me the child I already had. I can't remember the moment I understood that I had to turn my life around, but I do know why. I was terrified that the detective assigned to your case would call me with news and I'd be passed out. Or that, miracle, you'd show up at my door when I was out on a bender. What hurts the most, after all this time, is realizing that you had to disappear before I could find myself. 2 years after you were gone, I was completely sober, and I've never strayed since. The detective who was assigned to your kidnapping retired in 1990. He lives on a houseboat in Lake Powell. He sends Christmas cards with pictures of himself and his wife. He was the one who called me to tell me you'd been found. But before the phone rang that morning, I had already opened a carton of eggs to find them all upended and cracked. I had seen a line of fire ants spell out your initials on my driveway. By the time Detective LeGrand called, I already knew what he was going to say. There is one reading of Los Naipes that a person can do for herself. El Evangelio. It involves spreading 14 cards in the outline of the gospel and then 5 more in the shape of the cross. The first time I ever did El Evangelio, I was learning to read the cards at my mother's side. For many years, I stopped doing it altogether, because too often the Fool card came up in places I did not want to see it. But after you disappeared, I spread the cards every Sunday night. And every time, the same 2 major arcana would appear somewhere in the cross. Number 14, Temperance, warned of rash actions I'd regret for the rest of my life. Number 15, The Devil, said that someone had been lying to me. After Detective LeGrand called, I took out Los Naipes. It was not a Sunday evening, and it was not in my santuario, just across the kitchen table. As always, the devil and temperance popped up in the cross. But this time, there were 2 other cards that I hadn't seen there before. The star, which is the most potent card in the tarot deck, and neutralizes the other cards around it. Set next to the devil, like so, it meant that my old enemy was about to pay. From this day forth, your father would be powerless. The other card was the Ace of Wands, which any novice bruja will tell you stands for chaos. You have my hair and my smile. You also have my stubbornness. It's a little like having your past self come calling and wishing you could warn yourself about what will happen. You told me what you remembered about your childhood, but you didn't ask me what I remember. If you had, I would have said everything. From the moment you arrived in this world and curled stiff as a snail against the overwashed cotton of my hospital gown, to the licorice twist of your braids beneath my fingers, to the way I went to kiss you before you left with Charlie for your weekend visitation. So sloppy and sure of myself that when I missed your cheek and landed on air, I stupidly assumed I would have 1,000 more chances to get it right. After you vanished, I went to Mexico to visit a bruja with whom my mother had studied. She lived in a cottage with 3 blue iguanas who had the run of the house and who were rumored to be former men who had treated her badly. I went on June 13th, the feast of San Antonio de Padua. Her waiting room was packed with the needy, who shared their sad stories to pass the time. A woman who had left her grandmother's diamond ring in a public restroom. An elderly man who had misplaced the deed to his house. A child clutching a Perro Perdido flyer with a photo of a hot-eyed hound. a priest whose faith had gone off course. I waited silently, watching the red roosters peck at kernels of corn in her front yard. When it was my turn, I went into the santuario, handed the bruja the requisite small statue of San Antonio, along with my written description of what I had lost. She whispered a prayer and wrapped the statue in the paper. She tied it with a red string. 100 pesos, she said. I paid her and then drove north, pulling over at the first body of water I could find. I threw the package as far as I could into the reservoir and waited until I thought it might have sunk to the bottom. San Antonio is the patron saint of things that have gone missing. Make an offering on his feast day, and what's lost will be back in your possession within a year. Unless, that is, it has been destroyed. I went to that Mexican bruja every June until she died, and asked for the same spell each time. Year after year, when you were not returned to me, I never blamed her or San Antonio. I thought it was my fault. Something I had left out or gotten wrong in the written description of you, which grew longer every year, from paragraph to epic poem to masterpiece. I would spend the following 364 days crafting the note I would bring to the bruja the next time around, if you still hadn't turned up. Although that bruja is long dead, I think I finally know what I should have written. 28 years is a long time to think about why I loved you, and it's not for the reasons I first assumed. Because you swam in the space below my heart, or because you stanched the youth I was bleeding out daily, or because one day you might take care of me when I couldn't take care of myself. Love is not an equation, as your father once wanted me to believe. It's not a contract, and it's not a happy ending. It is the slate under the chalk, and the ground buildings rise from, and the oxygen in the air. It is the place I come back to, no matter where I've been headed. I loved you, Bethany, because you were the one relationship I never had to earn. You arrived in this world loving me more, even when I did not deserve it.
Part 4. Galway Canal, St. Francis and the Sow. Sometimes it is necessary to reteach a thing its loveliness. Eric. When I was 13 years old, I met the perfect girl. She was nearly as tall as I was, with corn silk hair and eyes the color of thunderstorms. Her name was Sandra. She smelled like lazy summer Sundays, mowed grass and sprinklers, and I found myself edging closer to her whenever I could, just to breathe in deeply. I imagined things in Sandra's company that I'd never bothered to imagine before. What it would feel like to walk barefoot on a volcano. How to find the patience to court all the stars, whether it physically hurt to grow old. I wondered about kissing, which way to turn my head, if her lips would save the impression of mine, the way my pillow always knew how to come back to the curve of my head night after night. I didn't talk to her because this was all so much bigger than words. I was walking beside Sandra when she suddenly turned into a rabbit and hopped away, disappearing underneath a hedge in the front of my house. The next morning when I woke up from my dream, it didn't matter that this girl had never existed. that I had been unconscious when I had conjured her. I found myself crying when I took the milk out of the refrigerator for my cereal. It was all I could do to get from one minute to the next. I spent hours sitting on the lawn, trying to find a rabbit in our shrubbery. Sometimes we don't know we're dreaming. We can't even fathom that we're asleep. I still think of her, every now and then. Our first week in Arizona passes slowly. I immerse myself in state case law. I wade through the prosecution's discovery. The environment seems to stir something up in Delia, who starts remembering more and more about her childhood. Snippets that usually make her cry. She summons the courage to go visit her father a couple more times. She takes long walks with Sophie and Greta. One morning I wake up and find Ruth Ann's trailer on fire. Smoke rolls over the roof in a thick gray cloud as I burst through the front door, yelling for my daughter, who spends more time over there than she does with us these days. But there are no flames inside, not even any smoke. And Sophie and Ruth Ann are nowhere to be found. I run around to the yard behind the trailer. Ruth Ann sits on a stump. Sophie's at her feet. The plume of gray smoke I saw in the front of the house comes from a small campfire. Set in its center are two cinder blocks with a thin flat stone balanced on top. A bead of water on the hot stone spits and dances. Ruth Ann doesn't look up at me, but takes a bowl filled with blue batter and ladles a spoonful onto the stone. She uses the flat of her hand to spread the batter as thin as it will go, pressing her palm down on the searing surface. As the batter solidifies into a circle, Ruth Ann takes an onion skin thin tortilla from a plate beside her and settles it on top of the one still cooking on the stone. She folds in the sides and then rolls from the bottom up, making a hollow tube that she passes over to me. "An egg McMuffin, it's not," she says. It looks and tastes like pale blue tracing paper. It sticks to the roof of my mouth. What's in it? Blue corn, rabbit ear sage, water. Oh, and ashes. Ruth Ann adds, "Peaky is an acquired taste." But my daughter, the one who will only eat macaroni and cheese if the noodles are straight, not curly, who insists that I cut the crusts off her peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and slice on the diagonal instead of the half, is stuffing this peaky in her mouth as if it's candy. "Siwa helped me grind the cornmeal yesterday," Ruth Ann says. "Siwa means Sophie," Sophie adds. "It means youngest sister," Ruth Ann corrects. "But that's still you." She spreads another circle of batter on the burning stone with her bare hand, lets it set, and flips it over in a seamless motion. "Finish telling me the story, Ruth Ann." Sophie looks over her shoulder at me. "You interrupted." "Sorry." "It's about a rabbit who got too hot." "Sandra, I think." Ruth Ann folds up another piece of peaky and rolls it into a paper towel, handing it to Sophie. "Where did I leave off?" "In the great heat," Sophie says, setting down cross-legged in front of Ruth Ann. "The animals were all droopy." "Yes, and Sikyatavo, rabbit, was worst of all. His fur was matted with red dirt from the desert. His eyes were so dry, they burned. He wanted to teach the sun a lesson." She folds another cone of peaky. "So Rabbit ran off to the edge of the world where every morning sun came up. He practiced with his bow and arrow the whole way. But when he got there, sun had left the sky. Rabbit thought that was cowardly. But he decided to wait for Sun to return the next day. Sun, though, had seen Rabbit practicing and decided to have a little fun with him. Back in those days, you see, sun didn't come up slowly like he does now. He'd burst into the sky with one leap. So the next day, sun rolled far away from where he usually jumped into the sky and then leaped up. By the time Rabbit got his bow and arrow together, sun was already so high he couldn't be touched. Rabbit stamped his foot and shouted, but sun only laughed. One morning, Ruth Ann continues, sun got careless. He jumped more slowly than usual, and Rabbit's arrow plunged into his side. Rabbit was delighted. He'd shot the sun. But when he looked up again, he saw how flames bled from the wound. Suddenly, the whole world seemed to be on fire. She stands up. Rabbit ran to a cottonwood and a greasewood tree, but neither one would hide him. They were too afraid of being burned to a crisp. Suddenly, he heard a voice calling to him. Sikyatavo, under me, hurry! It was a small green bush with flowers like cotton. Rabbit ducked beneath it just as the flames leaped over the bush. Everything crackled and hissed and then went quiet. Ruth Ann looks at Sophie. The earth all around was black and burnt, but the fire was gone. And the little bush that had saved Rabbit wasn't green anymore, but a deep yellow. Even today, that kind of bush grows green and then turns yellow when it feels the sun.
What happened to Rabbit? Sophie asks.
He was never the same. He has brown spots on his fur from where the fire burned him. And he's not so tough anymore, you know. He runs away and hides instead of putting up a fight. Sun isn't the same either, Ruth Ann says. He makes himself so bright that no one can look at him long enough to shoot straight.
Ruth Ann cracks her knuckles. Silver and turquoise rings wink like fireflies.
Let's clean up, she says to Sophie. And then if your dad says it's okay, you can come with me to the garage sale around the corner and scope out inventory.
Sophie runs into the house, leaving me alone with Ruth Ann. You don't have to keep her with you.
It's good to have a child to tell a story to.
Do you have any of your own? The lines of Ruth Ann's face carve deeper.
I had a daughter once.
Maybe we can all be divided along this rift. Those who have been lucky enough to keep our children, and those who have had them taken away from us. Before I can find the appropriate response, Sophie comes out of the house, dragging a bucket of sand behind her. She pours it onto the fire, banking the embers, a small cloud of soot sighing up around her knees.
Soph, I say, if you can be a good girl, you can stay with Ruth Ann a little longer.
Of course she can be good, Ruth Ann says. Where I come from, on Second Mesa, our grandmothers give us our names, and our grandfathers give us our manners. The ones who aren't good don't have grandfathers to tell them how to behave. And you have a grandfather, don't you, Siwa?
She hands Sophie the bowl of leftover batter.
Kitchen sink, she instructs.
The sun has risen high enough to gnaw on the back of my neck. I think of Rabbit and his arrow. Thanks, Ruth Ann. She gives me a half-smile.
Watch your aim, Sikyatavo, she warns, and she follows Sophie inside.
In 1977, in Arizona, a man could squirrel his daughter away to another part of the country, and it was considered kidnapping. By 1978, the laws had changed, and that same man, for the same act, would be charged with custodial interference, a lesser felony.
Jesus, Andrew, I murmur, poring over the books in my borrowed conference room at Hamilton Hamilton. Couldn't you have waited a few months?
Frustrated, I pick up one of the law books and whip it across the room, narrowly missing Chris as he walks in.
What's the matter with you?
He asks.
My client is an idiot.
Of course he is. If he wasn't, he wouldn't need a lawyer. Chris sits down and leans back in the chair across from me.
Boy, did you miss out last night, bud.
Picture a natural redhead named Lotus following me into the men's room at the Frantic Gecko to demonstrate how flexible a yoga instructor can actually be. And she had a friend who could lift her wine glass with her foot.
He smiles.
I know you're practically married, but still. You got any Tylenol?
I shake my head.
Then I definitely need coffee.
You take cream or sugar?
I don't drink.
Coming right up, he says, and he leaves.
I break out in a sweat, imagining already what it will be like to have a cup sitting on the table a few inches from me, steaming and fragrant. What most people don't understand is the interstitial space between lifting that mug and emptying its contents in the sink. In that instant, which is only as long as a thought, need can grow to such enormous proportions that it muscles reason out of the way. And before you know it, I am lifting the drink to my mouth. To drive my mind away from this, I start to flip through the pages of Arizona statutes to see if there's an affirmative defense for kidnapping, and finally find the paragraph I'm looking for. Section 13, paragraph 417. Necessity defense. Conduct that would otherwise constitute an offense is justified if a reasonable person was compelled to engage in the prescribed conduct, and the person had no reasonable alternative to avoid imminent public or private injury greater than the injury that might reasonably result from the person's own conduct. Or, in other words, I had to do it. Having an alcoholic wife isn't a reason to steal a child. However, if I can prove that Elise was an alcoholic, that she couldn't care for the child, that a call was made to protective services or the police, and that they didn't respond adequately, well, then Andrew has a shot at acquittal. A jury might be convinced that Andrew had exhausted all other possible options, that he had no choice but to take his daughter and run. Provided first that Andrew can convince me. Chris walks into the conference room.
Here you go, he says, sliding the mug across the table. The breakfast of champions. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'm going to find a physician to surgically remove my head.
After he leaves, I walk toward the steaming mug. It has been years since I've taken a sip, and I can still taste the beautiful bitter of it. I inhale deeply. Then I dump the coffee, china mug and all, into the trash.
This ends Disc 6. Vanishing Acts, Disc 7.
The detention officer manning the visiting area at the jail nods at me.
Take any empty one, he says.
It's a quiet morning. The doors are all shut, and the lights are off. I open the first door on the right and turn on the light, only to find an inmate with his striped pants down around his ankles, screwing his attorney on top of the Formica conference table.
Son of a bitch,
the guy says, his hand reaching to pull up his shorts. The woman blinks in the sudden light and tugs her pencil skirt down, knocking over a box full of files. Let me guess, I say cheerfully to the lawyer.
Pro boner work?
With an apology, I settle myself into the next room to wait for Andrew. He comes in as I'm still picturing the attorney next door, a pubic defender, I guess you'd call her, and smiling.
What's so funny? Andrew asks.
It's the kind of story that a week ago I would have told him over dessert. But Andrew is dressed in the same stripes and pink thermals as the man next door, and that is sobering.
Nothing.
I clear my throat. Look, we need to talk about your case. There is a right way and a wrong way to go about presenting an affirmative defense to a client. You basically explain where the escape hatch is and then say,
If you had a ladder to get up there, you'd be home free, hoping like hell that your client will be bright enough to then volunteer that he does indeed have a ladder hidden away in his breast pocket. The fact that a ladder can't possibly fit in his breast pocket, or that he never in his life owned a ladder, is not nearly as important as the fact that he tells you, flat out, that he is in possession of one. As the attorney, all you need to do is hint to the jury about the ladder. You don't have to physically present it. Sometimes the client gets what you're trying to do, sometimes he doesn't. At best, you're leading your star witness. At worst, you're suggesting that he lie to you so that you have some semblance of a defense. Andrew, I say carefully, I've been looking at the charges that were filed against you, and there is a defense that we might be able to use. Basically, it means saying that things were so bad in the household that you had no other alternative but to do what you did, which is take Delia away. The thing is, for this defense to apply, you also have to show that you had no alternative legal means of solving the problem. I give Andrew a moment to let this all sink in. Delia told me that your ex-wife is an alcoholic. Maybe that impaired her ability to function as a good mother? Slowly, Andrew nods. Maybe you felt you deserved custody of Delia because of this? Well, wouldn't you have? I hold up a hand. Did you call the police? Or Child Protective Services? A social worker? Did you try to get your custody agreement revisited in court? Andrew shifts in his seat. I thought about it, but then I realized it wasn't a good idea. My heart sinks. Why not? You saw that assault conviction the prosecutor had. What the hell was that all about anyway? He shrugs. Nothing, a stupid bar fight. But I wound up in jail overnight because of it. Back then, the courts automatically gave custody to a mother, even when the father had a spotless background. If you had a strike against you already, well, you might as well kiss your kid goodbye. He looks up at me. I was scared that if I went to complain about Elise, they'd look up my record and decide I shouldn't even have visitation anymore, much less full custody. The necessity defense implies there was no legal alternative remaining. But this is not the scenario Andrew's painted. He didn't even try a legal route before exacting his own vigilante justice. But instead of telling him how damaging this is to his case, I just nod. The first rule of defense law is to keep your client believing that there is always a light at the end of the tunnel, a slim possibility for a better outcome. When you get right down to it, the relationship between a defendant and a lawyer isn't all that different from the one between a child and an alcoholic parent. It's not like I didn't try, Andrew says. I spent months following the rules. Even the day I left, I took her home first. My head snaps up. This is news to me. You what? Beth had forgotten this blanket she used to take everywhere, and I knew she'd be miserable all weekend without it, so we went back. The place was a mess. The kitchen was piled high with dishes, and food was rotting on the counter. The refrigerator was empty. Where was Elise? In the living room. Out cold. I have a sudden mental picture of the woman, lying face down with her arm trailing off the couch, and the sweet curl of bourbon soaking into the cushions where the bottle has spilled. But in my picture, the woman doesn't have black hair like Elise Vasquez did when I saw her in court. She's a blonde, and she's wearing a pair of orange capri pants that were my mother's favorite. All of the memories I have of my mother smell like alcohol, even the good ones, when she was bending down to kiss me goodnight, or straightening my tie before my high school graduation. Her disease was a perfume, one I used to lean into when I was a child, and one I itched for when I was an adult. If you ask me for 5 concrete recollections from when I was a kid, chances are that 3 of them will involve some fiasco based on my mother's drinking.
The time it was her turn to be den mother and the Boy Scout troop arrived to find her completely lit and dancing in her underwear. The track championship she slept through. The sting of her hand on my face when she actually wanted to punish herself. These memories are the pillars I built my life on. But hiding behind them are the other memories, the ones that only peek out when I let down my guard. The hazy afternoon, my mother and I sat with our heads bent over the sidewalk, watching ants construct a mobile city. Her voice, off-key, singing me awake in the morning. The summer days when she staked trash bags on the lawn and ran a hose, a makeshift slip-and-slide for the two of us. Her inconsistency, in a better light, became spontaneity. You cannot hate someone until you know what it might be like to love them. Was having an occasional mother better than not having one at all? Andrew has read my mind. You know what that's like for a kid, Eric. If it had been up to you, would you have wanted a household like the one you grew up in? No. I didn't want to grow up in a household like mine, but I did. And I hadn't wanted to turn out just like my mother either. But I had. What did you do? I ask. I took Delia and left. I meant before that. Did you bother to see whether your ex-wife was all right? Did you call anyone to take care of her? She wasn't my responsibility anymore. Why not? Because you had a piece of paper saying you'd gotten divorced? Because I'd done it 1,000 times before, Andrew says. Are you defending me or Elise? For God's sake! Delia was in the very same situation when she got pregnant, except you were the one lying drunk on the floor. But she didn't run away from me, I point out. She waited for me to get my head straight. So don't even begin to compare your situation to hers, Andrew, because Delia's a better person than you ever were. A muscle ticks in Andrew's jaw. Yeah. I guess whoever raised her must have really known what he was doing. He stands up and walks out of the conference room, beckoning to an officer to take him back to the safety of his cell. Delia calls me on my cell phone while I'm driving back to Hamilton. Guess what? She says. I got a phone call from that prosecutor, Ellen Emma. Whatever. I can hear the smile in her voice. She asked to meet with me, and I told her I had a spot in my calendar between hell freezing over and not in this lifetime. Where are you, anyway? I'm on my way back from the jail. There is a silence. So how is he? Great, I say, adding a lift to my voice. We've totally got this under control. My cell phone beeps, another incoming call. Hang on, Dee, I tell her, and I switch over. Talcott. It's Chris. Where are you? I look over my shoulder at the merging traffic. Headed onto Route 10? We'll get off it, he says. You need to go back. The hair stands up on the back of my neck. What happened to Andrew? Nothing that I know of. But you just got some mail from Emma Wasserstein. She's filed a motion to remove you as counsel. On what grounds? Witness tampering, Chris says. She thinks you're feeding information to Delia. I slam down the phone, cursing, and it rings immediately. I've forgotten that Delia was on the other line. What else did you say to the prosecutor? I ask. Nothing. She was trying to do the buddy thing, you know, but I wasn't falling for it. She said she wanted to meet with me, and I refused. She pumped me for information about my father. I swallow. What did you say? That it wasn't any of her business, and that if she was fishing for information about him, she'd have to talk to you, just like I do. Oh, shit. Who called? Delia asks. Who was on the other line? A courtesy call from Verizon. I lie. You were on for a long time.
Well, they were being very courteous.
Eric, Delia asks, did my father say anything else about me?
Her question is clear as a bell. The cell phone reception is crystalline. But I hold the phone away from my ear. I make static noises.
Dee, can you hear me? I'm going under some power lines.
Eric?
I'm losing you,
I say. And I hang up while she's still talking. In the motion filed by Emma Wasserstein, Delia is referred to as the victim. Every time I read the word, I think how much she would hate that. Chris, Emma, and I sit in Judge Noble's chambers, waiting for His Honor to speak. Massive and formidable, he's busy spreading peanut butter on a cheese sandwich.
Do I look fat to you, Counselor?
The judge asks, although the question is directed at none of us in particular.
Robust, Emma answers.
Healthy, Chris adds.
Judge Noble pauses his knife and looks up at me.